Support for this podcast comes from the UTSA Institute of Texan Cultures, telling stories of Texas history and heritage from diverse cultures that define the state's unique character for over 50 years. Details at texancultures.utsa.edu.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. In a few minutes, we're going to be talking about the history of protest in America and what is that power to affect change? Is that change is sustainable? And how effective is a protest march? But right now, we're joined by Dominic Anthony Walsh. He's a reporter for Texas Public Radio, and he's been covering the San Antonio protest. And Dominic, welcome to The Source.
Thank you.
So you have been out on the streets with these protest march since this thing began. How are things changed now?
Right. So it's less tense than it was early last week, a week ago, Saturday and Tuesday, when you saw some police use projectiles. There are slightly fewer numbers since last Saturday when you saw thousands march. It's moved more to the hundreds. You've also seen the location of the protests move. Outside of downtown, they're still doing stuff downtown, but you've seen things in Alamo Heights, in the Pearl, and today in Southtown. And the protests also have shifted focus from just a general protest against police brutality to kind of looking ahead. What's next for these protesters in terms of organization, in terms of asking for policy changes?
So it seems initially the protests were an eruption of outrage, an emotional response to an injustice that people saw through the video that we saw of the death of George Floyd.
Right.
And now we're seeing more of a crafted message and policies that people want to see brought about in with their local police.
Exactly. And there's quite a bit of difference between individual protesters and what those policies look like. On the one hand, you have people who kind of want to reform the police department. And that looks like, you know, banning chokeholds, increasing training for de-escalation, taking on the police unions. They point out that over half of police officers who are fired in San Antonio get rehired. They also want a civilian oversight board. There's another group of protesters who say, that's all great, but we want to go further. We want to defund and dismantle the police department, give police officers far fewer responsibilities, especially when it comes to, situations involving mental health, situations involving people experiencing homelessness. There is no singular message. Each protester has a different take on what they want to see, but that's the conversations you're starting to see now is, what should we ask for from the city, from the police department, from the police union?
And the police, they have responded differently over the past few days as well. We've seen changes to their response.
I have not seen a police officer in riot gear since Tuesday. Tuesday was the last day that we know of that police projectiles were fired. And that situation, definitely you did not see great de-escalation on the part of SAPD. Multiple journalists were there. We all agree we saw a single water bottle thrown at the line of police officers in riot gear. After that, a couple minutes passed of complete peace. And later the next day, we saw a video from Ken's 5. There were officers in SWAT gear moving, and one of them had a confrontation with the protester. He was asking him to move back. He shoved him. And then police opened fire and continued to fire. They shot tear gas, pepper pellets, rubber bullets, wooden bullets. Flashbangs. So not great de-escalation on Tuesday evening on the part of SAPD.
So there's also been a city council meeting, and we saw people interrupting a city council meeting, demanding defund the police. Is there a sophisticated understanding of what that means, defund the police? Is it just a catchphrase, or is it actually a policy?
Again, it varies from protester to protester. There are people who have a very concrete understanding of what they want to see. Sometimes they want to reallocate those funds into community programs. Some people want to see a more community-oriented model of policing where you actually have, block patrols with people from your community patrolling your community rather than, having armed police officers. But again, it varies from person to person. Right now, there really is no hegemonic, singular vision for what these protesters want.
I want to air a clip of audio. This is from Joy Palacios, another reporter. He recorded this. This is from Trevor Jackson, Wagner High School teacher who was protesting.
That's why I'm out here. Because I need the ones that look up to me to understand that I'm fighting for them, that they have a voice. It doesn't matter how young you are. It doesn't matter where you come from. It doesn't matter your socioeconomic level. It doesn't matter anything. All that matters is your heart. And if you're willing to see that black lives truly do matter, then you'll be out here fighting. That you'll speak. That you'll let your voice be heard. I can't be silenced anymore. They silenced my ancestors. They hold those before me. They're arresting and killing those that look just like me to this day. So I'm still fighting the same fight.
Dominic Anthony Walsh, you've been covering these protests for Texas Public Radio. That was Trevor Jackson, Wagner High School teacher, very emotional, speaking from the heart about what brought him out to a protest. Is that typical of what we're seeing from people who were standing out in the heat, now way over 90 degrees, really out, it's dealing with a lot of discomfort to actually take part in these events?
Absolutely. A lot of people really just want their voices to be heard. That's why you see them choosing the locations they're choosing. San Antonio Public Safety Headquarters has been a consistent site. You see, you know, hundreds of protesters chanting outside of SAPD headquarters. You've also seen protesters go to the Pearl, to Alamo Heights, where you have more well-to-do residents and clientele of businesses. And they've said basically they want to bring these protests, these messages, outside of the downtown area. They want to make sure that a lot of residents in San Antonio hear, feel, and see these protests.
Typically, the power structure will just kind of wait it out. Wait for these protesters to get tired, and they're going to go away, and we'll go back to doing the things that we've always done. Any signs that this is different here in San Antonio?
We've seen Sheriff Javier Salazar, the Bexar County Sheriff. We've seen Mayor Ron Nirenberg. Both of them have addressed the protests directly. In terms of concrete policy promises, they haven't really made anything specific. Mostly, they promised to continue listening. From what I've heard, Chief William McManus, SAPD chief, has also been in touch with a few protesters. He hasn't, spoken to a group, but he has watched from his car, and then he's also been on the phone with a few protesters. And my understanding is that all three of them will be in meetings with various activists and protesters in the coming weeks.
Interesting. One of the biggest signs that there may be some sort of change of foot is the announcement from the president of the San Antonio Police Officers Association, the police union, Mike Kelly, saying that he will not seek re-election to that post. He's been a strong advocate protecting of officers convicted or dealing with misconduct.
The activists really want to take on the police union. That's going to be one of the most interesting areas to watch. Again, they point out that over half of officers fired in San Antonio are rehired through the arbitration process. Chief McManus has gone on record with the Washington Post saying that he's not really a fan of that process. So it'll be really interesting to see what happens with the police union and the activists.
Really quickly, is there a protest for today?
Yes, in Southtown at 4 p.m.
All right, Dominic Anthony Walsh, reporter for Texas Public Radio, giving us an update on the protest scene here in San Antonio, reacting to the death of George Floyd. When we come back from the break, we're going to be talking, looking at the historic context of these protests, what's happening across the nation, and what are your rights as a protester if you are arrested. What happens to you then? And you can call in. The number is 833-877-8255. As we have that conversation, Dominic, thank you again. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We've seen two major protest movements in the United States in recent weeks. One of them was calling for the reopening of the economy during the COVID-19 response. This was made up of individuals frequently heavily armed, calling for being able to get a haircut and be able to go back to work. Now we're seeing protests of people who are taking to the streets, calling for heavy police reform. rising from the police killing of George Floyd. Now, these protests have actually a lot in common, even though they're coming from two different spaces on the political spectrum. What is it about a protest? How do they work, and how do they actually affect change? And what are your rights in a protest? What do you want to see in a protest to actually make it work well? Call in. We want to hear from you, 833-877-8255. Have you taken part in these protests? Were you frustrated, or were you invigorated? What was your reaction from actually taking part, having a role there? 833-TPR-TALK. You can also email us at thesource@tpr.org. We're joined by Pinnell Joseph. He is the director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy and professor of history and public affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. His most recent book is The Sword and the Shield, The Revolutionary Lives of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King. And Professor Joseph, welcome to The Source.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us, Kelly Carter Jackson, historian and assistant professor of humanities and African American studies at Wellesley College, author of Force and Freedom, Black Abolitionist and the Politics of Violence. Professor Jackson, it's great to have you.
Happy to be here.
And also joining us is Andre Segura. He is the legal director of the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU of Texas. Andre, welcome back to The Source.
Hi, excited to be part of the conversation.
So, Pinnell Joseph, tell me, what are you seeing right now as you see these protests in the United States reacting to the death of what's going on here?
Well, yeah, I think we have a generational opportunity here to end institutional racism and to defeat white supremacy and to really finish the work of people like Ella Baker, Fannie Lou Hamer, King, Malcolm X, Ida B. Wells, who are pushing for Black dignity and citizenship. I'd say that these protests are about much more than the criminal justice system, which has to be fundamentally transformed. They're really an acknowledgement that the criminal justice system in the United States represents a gateway to panoramic systems of oppression that are connected to housing, that are connected to education, that are connected to the amplification of residential and public school segregation since the heroic period of the civil rights movement. And I would actually push back on what your reporter said. There is actually common knowledge. People were talking about defunding the police nationally. This is connected to prison abolition. It's connected to reparations. It's connected to people saying they want a redistribution of wealth in the same manner that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. articulated during the Poor People's Campaign. King, and not Andy Yang, was the first person talking about a universal basic income in 1965, 66, 67, 68. So they want guaranteed citizenship, not just for Black people, but for all people. But this is going through the Black liberation and the Black freedom struggle, along with Latinx and white allies now globally, because people realize that Black people are the lowest common denominator when it comes to immiseration and dehumanization, incarceration, punishment, public executions and murder, and disinvestment in the United States. So we're seeing something that we haven't seen in these large numbers since the 1960s. We haven't seen these large numbers of protesters nationally and globally since the heyday of the civil rights and Black Power movement. And certainly we're seeing more white allies and would-be allies come to the fore. And these protests have been both organized and spontaneous. And we're seeing national political mobilization, but we've got to give credit to the Black Lives Matter movement and Black women and Black queer feminists who organized the Black Lives Matter movement. The movement for Black Lives has a policy agenda that talked about reparations, that talked about reallocating resources from criminal justice into the work of anti-poverty. And we're in Texas, completing the work of the Great Society that was hijacked by both the Vietnam War and white supremacy to fund criminal justice that was targeting Black and brown people over the last 52 years, and the murder of George Floyd, the murder of Breonna Taylor, the murder of these Black women and men consistently has finally pushed us towards an inflection point where we're saying we're going to not only dismantle these institutions of racial oppression out there on the streets, we're saying we're going to reimagine American democracy, how democratic institutions work in civil society and start at the local level, definitely get to the state and the federal level, but voting is not enough. Everybody has to be organizing to repudiate racist policies at the local level. That's San Antonio. That's in Texas here in Austin. My city, a 20-year-old is in a coma from a police rubber bullet. This is all morally reprehensible, and now it's finally politically untenable.
So I want to get back to the defunding of police, although that's not solely what I want to talk about. But I do want to raise awareness of what that actually means and what it doesn't mean. Can you give me some really give me a capsule of what I should think about when I hear defund the police?
Well, people are talking about reimagining public safety in the United States. So from that perspective, it can mean things like restorative justice. It means that if you are stopped in a traffic stop, somebody with a gun isn't the person stopping you. It could mean that all the people who have mental health crisis and are in crisis, it's not the cops who are the first people to get to them. It means that law enforcement is not going to be utilized as social workers, as mental health workers, as after-school child care workers. We use law enforcement to do the things that anti-poverty and social justice and the Great Society wanted a whole social welfare safety, social safety net to do. And now we use law enforcement primarily because we defunded schools. When people talk about defunding the police, what they're saying is that we've defunded schools, we've defunded hospitals, we've defunded healthcare for black and brown people in the United States, and we're going to reallocate those resources. Los Angeles is doing it now. It doesn't mean you're not going to have any public safety. What it means is that instead of investing in criminal justice and incarcerating 2.3 million people, having 9 million people on parole or probation, and constantly marginalizing and punishing even black children who are arrested from school at the age of 5, 6, right here in Texas, instead of doing that, we actually invest in black and brown communities. We invest in racial integration, finally, and we invest in redistributing resources for the people who are most in need in every single state, every single city and hamlet in the United States.
Kelly Carter Jackson, can you tell me why some people are calling these protesters un-American? What does that mean?
Oh, man. I mean, it's intensely problematic to call Americans un-American for protesting when this country was founded on protest. So if you go back to the early revolutionary moment, I mean, people are using these slogans of give me liberty or give me death and talking about what it means to protest for liberty and equality and justice. And so to call it un-American, I think, is a little bit ridiculous and disingenuous. But what I think we're also seeing in this moment is that not just black people, but their allies are stepping up to the plate in ways we have not seen before, in ways where this protest movement feels completely different to me because of the level of participation from not just black people of all throughout the demographic, but white people as well, LGBTQ people, the Latinx community, to see even cops participating in some of these protests. It's, to me, quite remarkable, but to call it un-American is just not historically accurate.
Andrea Segura with the ACLU of Texas. Do you see this as a historic civil rights moment?
I do. We're seeing some of the biggest crowds ever in Houston, where I am. These protests outnumber anything we've seen in the past. This has definitely awakened more people than have before. Speaking of, you know, concepts like defunding the police and that being part of our national conversation right now is amazing and noteworthy. A lot of people have been calling for this for a long time. And it is fundamentally not a radical concept. I think when people hear defund the police, they think it means that our public safety budgets will go down to zero. It's actually quite not controversial. We've come to rely on the police for far too much, as was said before, for responding to mental health crises and things of that nature. And this is about redistributing and reimagining what we think of the police. And so we're seeing people from across the spectrum engaging in their fundamental right to protest. This is guaranteed under the First Amendment, and it's for this very reason. It is one of the most direct and effective ways for people to make their voices heard on matters, as you mentioned, from, you know, something like reopening America to this critical issue right now about the lives of Black people in this country and the call for police reform. This is the way, and that right is fundamental. And for people to call out individuals as un-American for engaging in that is quite shocking.
I want to play a voicemail that we received, and here we go.
My name is William B. Johnson. I'm a 77-year-old African-American male who served in the United States Air Force, discharged honorably. Yes, I participated in the rally that happened in San Antonio Travis Park some time ago. I was led to do so basically because I think it's time that all decent-minded people stand up for the idea that Black lives do in fact matter. And further, that police cannot be condoned to continue their behavior as usual against Black people. They must be reined in, and one way to do that is through our elected officials, but they are driven primarily by the numbers, and people who stand up and demand the right thing, there's a better chance for us to have justice done. When I see people in the valley saying Black, brown, stand up, I'm encouraged. When I see demonstration in Alamo Heights, I'm encouraged. So, heck, if they are doing it, these young people, I definitely should be standing up. As a Black male who's been in this country, has experienced a lot, and I see changes in the wind, and I'm hoping that the pressure will continue until decent changes that are needed, take place. Thank you very much.
Do you think change is coming to America? You think change is coming to the way we interact with police? We're talking about that today on The Source. And so really quickly, I'd like to get a reaction to that from Peniel Joseph.
Yeah, I think that's a great sentiment. And I think that there's policy changes happening already. There's grassroots organizing that's happening. There are people who are philanthropists, and I agree with Professor Jackson that there's so many white allies who want to join this fight and join this struggle, and I think they should, but they have to also realize that there are people who are experts and who are on the ground who've been doing this work, and you have to align yourself with those people, put your resources into those people locally rather than try to reinvent the wheel and sort of take leadership in a context that you don't really understand. Although we see the New York Times bestsellers list that right now books about anti-racism. People want to find out this history. There's definitely a whole new young generation that is looking at these protests, and they're looking at their own stories and connecting their stories with George Floyd and with Breonna Taylor and all these different people who've been killed and murdered by the police. And so there's this search for intersectional justice that's happening here, which is very, very tremendous and very, very powerful. And in a large way, we owe Black feminists and Black queer feminists and Black activists for this moment.
This is music plays a big part in protest movements. This is a song that was sung in the streets of Minneapolis recently, We Shall Overcome, and it certainly harkens back to other protest movements. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 833-877-8255. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies, taking to the streets and protesting. It is as American as the flag, because that's how we got it. You know, we protested for civil rights against Jim Crow. Women protested in the streets in order to gain the vote. We had unions. We had labor protesting in the streets in order to gain the right to organize and all sorts of parts of our lives. lives good things have come about because people have fought for them in the courts and in the streets. What have you experienced in the protests so far? And what protests have you joined? There's a lot of them out there. And what do you think? Was it worth it for you to get out of your home, go out in the streets, be uncomfortable and be jostled, maybe being deal with a confrontation with the police? Was that worth it to you? Call in 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Let's go to Cynthia on the phones. And Cynthia, thanks for calling in. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm a 52-year-old white female, and my family and I went to the original protest down at Travis Park last Saturday, and it was very peaceful, and we were all chanting Black Lives Matter. We were fully in. I've grown up going to protests, with ERA protests with my mother. We were walking with the people, and then the man behind us started screaming, kill the pigs, and it started to turn a little bit violent. And that's what I'm trying to reconcile with, is the people inciting the violence with our peaceful protest. Because I feel like the message is getting lost with the incitement of anger. With the incitement of violence.
Sure. Cynthia, thank you for the call. Kelly Carter Jackson, historian, assistant professor of humanities and African studies at Wellesley College, author of Force and Freedom, Black Abolitionist and the Politics of Violence. We're seeing a lot of attention towards the breaking in of some businesses and other things. Is that normal?
Normal is an interesting word. I would say that it's problematic for sure. But I think I'm always more disturbed about the narrative that the media has put forth, and that, you know, the reason why people are protesting and the reason why people are upset is because, you know, a man is dead. George Floyd is dead. Breonna Taylor is dead. Ahmaud Arbery is dead. And I think that while talking about the destruction of buildings or looting is useful, I would hesitate to make that the center of the conversation. I think these outbursts that we have seen are exceptional, that they are not the rule, that they are not what's generally happening at most of these protests. And sometimes there's a tendency to harp in on footage of looters or of, you know, people who are attempting to start violence to distract from what people are really angry about and what is truly grievous, which is the fact that hundreds, if not thousands, of Black people have lost their lives to police brutality. And so I am all for the anger. I understand the anger. I understand angry chants. I even understand why people might want to take up a much more aggressive approach. But what I also caution people to think about is the fact that buildings and businesses can always, and always do historically, recover from instances of, you know, destruction. But the people who have lost their lives will never, ever be able to recover again. They will never get their fathers back. They will never get their sons or daughters back. And that has to be the center of the discussion. That has to be the focus of the discussion. I think focusing on things that are exceptional and attempting to make them the rule is not appropriate. I think we can push back on the people that are causing destruction, but we really need to be focusing on the fact that what is most destructive is the relationship the police community has to the Black community.
Let's go to another caller. Michael has called in. Michael, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yes, I just want to relate my experience at the Travis Park rally on Saturday. I left right as the march had ended, before things started turning nasty. I had no idea it was going to turn nasty, but I left. And to get back to my car, I had to walk through the Tobin grounds area, through several different groups of various officers, just kind of sitting there, you know, waiting for whatever happens. And I was carrying my sign because I wanted them to see the sign. Slavery ended 155 years ago. It's time Blacks were freed from white supremacy violence. Justice for police killings now. And I let them see the sign. And a couple of times I actually had a brief exchange with the officers. And I was able to do that. I was all by myself. I know I was able to do that because I have immunity from any type of police violence because of my whiteness. So my white privilege allowed me access to that opportunity that I'm sure Black individuals would not have.
All right. Thank you for that call, Michael. So Panil Joseph, director at the Center for Study of Race and Democracy and a professor of history, public affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. Are we seeing people trying to use their white privilege to shake things up?
No, absolutely. And I think that's one of the hopeful signs here. I think that here's how we have to think about what's happening, where we see tens of thousands of people marching in Germany, marching in London, marching in the United States, really hundreds of thousands of people. We're at a watershed moment. It's an inflection moment. You can think of this as people have been talking about 68, but you can also think about this in the context of 1963, because 63 is not just the March on Washington on August 28th. It's also Birmingham, Alabama, and it's also we have about 10,000 people who've been arrested the past couple of weeks through these protests. In 1963, between May and June, there's going to be about 15,000 people arrested for all these civil rights demonstrations, including white allies. It's not going to be as big scaled as this has been, but it's similar. And what President Kennedy does is he doesn't call in 10,000 troops or barricade the White House. What he does is make this really riveting speech on June 11th, 1963. He's inspired by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from Birmingham Jail, and he says that civil rights is a moral issue. But Kennedy also says, live address to the nation on June 11th, 1963, he says and admits that there's a revolution taking place. He says there's a revolution at hand, and it can be either violent or peaceful. And what President Kennedy says, and really his finest moment as President of the United States, he says that those who do nothing invite shame and violence. Those who act boldly recognize right as well as reality. So we're seeing a revolution. It's a nonviolent revolution for the most part. Most of the violence that we've seen has been police violence, which is why there's been call to transform our public safety in the United States from top to bottom. Because there's been not just innocent black people being hurt and maimed and killed, but we've seen white allies, including in Buffalo, being brutalized by a criminal justice system that's broken from top to bottom. So we're seeing a sea change nationally, and certainly we've seen it with the National Football League. Even as they're not mentioning Colin Kaepernick, the players forced the commissioner to say Black Lives Matter, to say that there's a systemic racism problem in the United States. So right now, the president of the United States, what's going on in the White House, is absolutely irrelevant, because democracy is in the streets of the United States and globally. And people want to reimagine democracy from top to bottom. Yes, racial justice, but people want economic justice. People want equality for women. People want equality for LGBTQ. People want environmental transformation. But they're seeing that the beating heart of American democracy is the quest for racial justice in our lifetime. And it's the work of a generation, but we can do it. We have a generational opportunity. All the listeners right now, if you ever wondered, what would you have done in 1968 when Dr. King was alive, 1965 with Malcolm X, 1963 before Kennedy was assassinated, you're living it right now. And if you thought, what would you have done when Abraham Lincoln was alive during the 1860s and 1870s, where Professor Jackson is an expert on, we're living it right now. These are historic watershed times, and it's time to transform American democracy so, like Dr. King said, we can have a beloved community that's free of racism, that's free of war, violence, materialism, where we empathize with each other and we treat each other more as family than as strangers, and we treat black people with dignity and citizenship for the first time in the history of the republic.
Andre Segura with the ACLU of Texas. If I get arrested while protesting, what kind of charges would I be facing? Is this going to ruin my life?
Well, first off, it's important to respect, to understand fundamental rights. So you have the right not to have excessive force used against you. You have the right not to be arrested without probable cause, or to be stopped without reasonable suspicion. You fundamentally have the right to make your voice heard, and that has to apply equally. The person who is saying something more controversial, as the woman said before, is as protected to say that as anyone, as any other message, and the police can't restrict based on your message. There are limits, obviously, to that. Demonstrating and the right to protest is usually done in traditional spaces like the sidewalk, like in streets, gun parks.
Yeah, but I'm seeing there's thousands of people being arrested across the nation. And I'm wondering, like, arrested, and what are they being charged with? And is it just really just, you know, are they going to be having to go to trial? And how's what's all that like?
Well, fundamentally, no one should be arrested for things like obstructing when they weren't given a chance to disperse. When there's a traffic concern or people, for example, are on a freeway, the police need to first de-escalate and not arrest people before doing so. There are obviously a variety of reasons why arresting is not the solution to put more people in jail, to issue citations, and the consequences of doing that.
Sure. So I'm going to hit pause on you, right? I'm going to go to the break. But the reason I ask you this question, because a lot of people are afraid of what could happen to them if they do get arrested, and that's a deterrent to them. But if they need to have a realistic idea of what really, is it a ticket or what am I going to go through? So we're going to go to break and we'll be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the protest in America, and do they have the power to affect change in your rights in these circumstances? And I had to break off from Andre Segura. I want to pick up where we left off. Legal director for the American Civil Liberties Union of Texas, ACLU of Texas. And in an artful way, I asked the question, but I was trying to get at, if we get arrested, is that going to really be a disruption in my life, or is this something I can live with and, you know, go out and get arrested in the name of trying to bring about change, social change? Is that so bad? And what is the result if I did get arrested, Andre?
Yeah, well, first of all, you know, civil disobedience is an act that each individual has to take on for themselves. The infractions, the law still applies even during protests. So people and police could be looking out to arrest people for things like jaywalking, disorderly conduct, obstructing the roadway. If people become violent or cause a danger or harm people, they can obviously be arrested for those things as well. But if you're looking to protest and you do things and you follow the law, and you need to make sure that you're not putting yourself in a situation where you could be arrested, you should be safe doing so. And the police have a responsibility to ensure that people are safe doing so. And if you want to go out and peacefully protest and not violate any laws while doing so, you have a right not to be arrested. One of the most problematic things that we have been seeing is these arrests en masse, where people are sort of pushed back or corralled into an area or kettled. We've seen throughout the country that this results in the arrests of people who are peacefully protesting and the arrests of journalists and the arrests of just bystanders. And these are highly problematic practices that we're seeing by police departments across the country. But fundamentally, your right to not be arrested without probable cause of a crime remains. So if you are out there and not committing any crime, you should have no problem.
Kelly Carter Jackson, historian, assistant professor of humanities, African American studies at Wellesley College, author of Force and Freedom, Black Abolitionist, and the Politics of Violence. We're playing some music clips. These are people singing in the streets of some songs, you know, the Sam Cooke song, Change Gonna Come. We just heard that. Can you talk about how music plays a role in a protest?
I mean, when I think about history and I think about sort of the soundtrack that goes along with each historical moment, when I think about slavery, I think of the Negro spirituals and how the songs that were sang by enslaved people were so pivotal in our understanding of what they were experiencing and what they were going through. when I think about the 1920s and 30s at the turn of the 20th century, and I think about sharecropping, I think about the blues, and I think about how that music of sadness and depression stems directly from the oppressive relationships that people had sharecropping and working in the field. When you think about even something as rebellious as rock and roll, right? When you think about people like Little Richard or people that are singing R&B and Aretha Franklin that are using their songs and their music to inform the movement. I think about in the 1980s and 90s, hip-hop, right, is a direct response to mass incarceration and deindustrialization. And I think that we can pull from any of those genres, even in this very moment, and think about music that sort of fuels our understanding or operates as a soundtrack to how we might be feeling in this particular moment. I think Black music is perfect for that. I think gospel music is something that I've been listening to a lot because of how it connects me spiritually, but also how it connects me with the grievances of the world all around me. So music has really been a powerful, potent tool in how people navigate these really difficult times. And so I think that you will always have music and a movement, particularly when it deals with Black people. You're always going to have music and a movement. And some of that music can be sorrowful, and some of that music can be really encouraging and really empowering. But music is so, so important.
Another caller, let's go to Robert. And Robert, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hey, thank you for taking the call. I'm 68, haven't been able to go to the protest, but I'm in solidarity with them. I use social media to express my viewpoint. I think we need police reform. For too long, the establishment within the police department and outside the police department have been protecting the bad officers that abuse our citizens. This is a call to the good police officers. Stop protecting the bad police officers. It is time for change. It is time to have a better police department.
Robert, thank you for the call. Peniel Joseph, PhD, director of the Center for Race and Democracy, and a professor of history and public affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. We're seeing people on social media trying to discredit the protesters, frequently trying to say that Martin Luther King would not be acting this way, would not be in favor of the way these protests are being conducted. There is certainly an effort to try to reframe what Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was all about here.
Yeah, they're exactly wrong, because what Dr. King says famously is that riots are the language of the unheard. But even more than that, he says that the United States needs to find out the roots behind the violence, right? So when we think about Dr. King is a political revolutionary and a faith leader who's nonviolent, but is trying to use massive nonviolent civil disobedience and to occupy Washington, D.C. in 1968 until people all have a guaranteed income. So the pernicious way that so many conservatives and people on the right have tried to smear Dr. King by utilizing his legacy to attack protesters is way off base. But I think what's so interesting in the time period we're living, the hyper-partisanship that has come about because Washington is broken and because government is not working for people, means that trying to smear these protests, we're seeing that in the polling data too. People are upset for many, many different reasons, including the government's response to COVID-19, Black people disproportionately impacted and suffering. And so smearing these protests will not work. And people, this is very similar, and again, Professor Jackson can speak about this, to right before the Civil War, where people were either pro-slavery or anti-slavery, you know, and David Blight has written about this. This is a really, really, this is an inflection point. Whether you're for segregation and Jim Crow or you're against it, are you for Black lives or are you against it? And so people who are going to use any single excuse in the book not to recognize George Floyd or Breonna Taylor's humanity, they're just isolated at this point. They're isolated. We're seeing so many white allies, including at times corporations who've never been interested in Black lives, come to the fore, both rhetorically but with pledges to try to transform their own culture. So I think we're seeing a sea change. I think we do have a generational opportunity before us. And again, in the words of James Baldwin, to finally achieve our country, instead of having such a huge juxtaposition between the way in which we imagine ourselves to be as the United States of America, liberty's surest guardian, at home and abroad, and the way we actually are in terms of marginalizing, murdering, segregating, impoverishing tens of millions of our own citizens.
Kelly Carter Jackson, I want to get to what makes a protest work. We've seen protests come up and people go to the streets and they demand things and nothing happens. What makes a protest actually bring about sustainable change?
That's a really good question. You know, I wanted to address something that you brought up earlier, which is, you know, the idea that people are afraid about protesting and what the consequences, you know, will be to that. And, you know, James Baldwin has this great quote where he says, to act is to be committed, and to be committed is to put yourself in danger. And I think that we have to be really honest with ourselves about what it is going to cost us to rid ourselves of white supremacy. And are we willing to make that forfeiture? Are we willing to relinquish, you know, our privileges and benefits that are associated with whiteness? And so the changes that are needed are not just people marching in the streets. And I'm not saying that to belittle that, because we've seen how powerful it is to have these marches and to have this protest. But a lot of the change that is required for structural systemic change is both collective and individual. And I think people are asking themselves right now in this moment, what can I do to act, to be committed to that? And really asking the hard questions of, will this put me in danger? And, you know, not all danger is deadly. So we're not asking people to put their lives on the line, but we are asking them to think about, what are the ways in which you can relinquish the power, the benefits, the advantages that you have so greatly enriched white lives? When we think about the school districts that we send our children to, when we think about our purchasing power and what we buy and what businesses we support or don't support, I could go down the list in ways of which you can be an active participant in this movement and not necessarily march. One of the things that I had said in my own op-ed was that I'm a new mom. I have a new baby. And, you know, a lot of people in my family have pre-existing conditions. I cannot march and be out in the protest the way that I would want to be. But one of the ways I see a powerful tool I have is the pen. I can write. I can reach mass audiences with the pen, with my computer.
Right.
And I can get people informed as much as I possibly can. That's my job as a professor. That's how I see myself doing the Lord's
okay.
work. So I think we can all find a way to do it.
All right. Kelly Carter Jackson, thank you so much. Historian, assistant professor of humanities, African-American studies at Wellesley College. The book is Force and Freedom, Black Abolitionists and the Politics of Violence. Also with us, Peniel Joseph, PhD. His book is Revolutionary Lives of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. Also with us, Andre Sogoda with the ACLU of Texas.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Kim Johnson and Dallas Williams, with production assistance provided by me, Ruben Garcia. Dan Katz is TPR's news director. Support for The Source comes from contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.